Okay, hi, this is Armor Director John Clements again. Paul Champagne and I wanted to continue our interview. We had so many things that we still wanted to talk about that we decided to do a second part to our earlier interview shortly after we finished on the phone with the first one. 5 minutes later, we were back on the phone again, and we wanted to follow up. Paul wanted to add a few things about his education and background.
My education wasn't in engineering. My degree in education, but I got to spend a lot of time in with Norton Company, who makes a lot of abrasives, grinding wheels, melts, sharpening stones, where I got to work a lot with edged implements, sharpening of those implements.
Right.
So I got to look at the edges under the scanning electron microscope or in the lab. In fact, I was lucky enough to work with the sharpening stone division and work on changing some of the sharpening stone formula, so to speak, and actually come out with an American-made waterstone line, which was a lot of fun. And they got some fun resources to try, different stones, different just to analyze edges. A lot of it was for the project, and some was just for my own gratification. So
yeah,
that helped out down the road too.
Yeah, I could see how that would. Okay, so how exactly does knife making and knife smiths, how have they contributed to misinformation about historical swords? I mean, I know I have my own ideas about that, but I wonder if you have any insight into it, since you're having to do research and that obviously the knife community does not have.
It's I guess knives and swords that are made of steel and they have edges are very different animals.
Right.
What it takes to make a good knife, or maybe even the qualities you want for, say, edge hardness in a 6-inch long piece of steel, is going to be quite a bit different than what you want in something that has to handle a lot of impacts against armor that's 38 inches long and two-handed. So,
or to guard against
said,
the blades.
A sword is not a big knife.
Right.
That's the biggest thing, is just trying to use your concept of what to do to make a knife blade good and extend it out and say, voila, we have a good sword. And you don't. You're not worried about balance anywhere near as much in a knife, though you do, as you are with a sword. Impact strength.
Yeah.
The edge geometry for impact cutting versus slicing cutting, et cetera, et cetera. There's just so many differences. How a hilt can be put together and still survive.
Right.
I know in my early days, I started off with a great knife maker who first showed me how to fit and finish things, Barry Davis, who makes phenomenal knives. But you can't use knife and dagger techniques to put a sword together and hope it's going to stay together.
Yeah, that's been my big complaint, is that a lot of knife makers in the 70s and 80s and 90s even were making swords that were really just giant knives, and they didn't know what they were doing.
It made sense back then, but there's so much more research now on what swords actually had to do in test cutting. I mean, when did test cutting really start here? Well, there was some knife test cutting, things like that, but I remember when I was first trying to test my steel, trying to find people that could actually cut. That's how I got into the whole Japanese routine of things, because it just didn't exist anybody that really knew what they were doing or could base it on something that was historical.
Yeah.
So things have changed a lot in 20 years, for the better.
Yeah,
definitely for the
and I'm sure it's going to improve even more so, because I've seen that some knife makers have come out and said, hey, in fact, even a few sword makers come out and said, hey, what we made in the past, we know was not accurate, was not good. And I'm going, told you so, but at the time when we said that, they didn't like us saying it. But now they have the, wherewithal to admit it in some cases, which is fortunate.
I mean, and that's good change too, when people can actually put the ego aside and go, all right, yeah, I messed up on that one. It's going to happen.
Whereas you have other companies that will hold up their weapons and say, it's a great battle-ready sword, and we'll go, no, it's not, and we're the ones who know better, not you, we. And they don't
like
that.
That's a really important point. I've always found that, you have to work, a swordsmith can't work in isolation for his own testing. I can cut pretty well. I'm not a small guy. I'm not slow when I cut. But I want to test, was I going to just allow myself to do my own testing and say, oh, okay, I'm satisfied? No, I had to find somebody who did it professionally.
Yeah.
Try to find that. But I lucked out. I did. I changed to a European, a Japanese to test the steel and things like that. And it worked out, and I brought that knowledge back.
Yeah.
But, It's the same as if you were an engineer designing, you know, or a team of engineers designing a fighter jet, I always like to say.
Yes.
And you're going to work with a test pilot to push it to the bound.
Yeah, that's the analogy I always use.
Yeah, and then you're going to have a pilot that actually takes it out there and does a day-to-day mission. So you really need that whole, you know, it's like I can make things. You can test things and go, wow, right. There's no way I could do the techniques in the book with this because it's so tip-heavy.
Exactly. I always say you may be an aeronautical engineer and design a fighter jet, but you need a fighter pilot who's going to say, oh, guess what? It bled energy at 10,000 feet in a certain dive, or when I was doing an S-curve, this happened, or there was a blind spot here when I'm in this kind of degree dive, and the engineer is going to go, really?
Yeah, and then they decide, okay, does someone need to change, or is it there for a reason? I'm sorry, we can't change it, so then it modifies. You know, it can modify the blade side, it can modify the technique side, too.
That's right. An automotive engineer needs a race car driver to test his race car. And, myself, in particular, and Arma in general, has gotten a bad rap from some makers because they will go around saying, we don't need them to tell us how our swords should be made. We know better. We're sword makers. And what? then they loan their swords out to complete amateurs and complete know-nothings for testing. And they're cutting milk jugs.
And then it's a cheap way to cut. I'm not going to... I don't cut on water jugs, right. Milk jugs myself, but it is inexpensive, and you can learn some things from it. But the way I look at it is anybody can make anything to go through. I can take an unhardened piece of thin steel, put a semi-good edge on it, we can go through milk jugs.
Right.
But, I mean, what I find the problem is swords have to stay together, which means hard test cutting.
Right.
And different style blades will have to hold up to hard test cutting different, you know, to different amounts. You know, if this blade was never meant, it was just meant for unarmed opponents, it was a short, whatever. You have to gauge your hard cutting based upon what that sword had to see. Well, let's face it, a sword that was going to possibly bang into a helm on somebody's head.
Right.
You got to test those pretty hard. But should the guy buying the sword have to test this like that? No, the manufacturer should.
Yeah.
To destruction. So you know that you know what you're doing. I make handmade blades. And if I'm doing a new design, I'll make something, and I'll test it cutting right into iron.
Yeah, one of the complaints I often have is when I'm testing a sword, it's not so much the edge I'm testing at first as I'm touching is the thing holding together. Is the blade itself not going to bend or break or snap or the hilt break off or the pommel break off or what have you? And because I'm thinking, hey, if someone strikes at me and I need to displace their cut with a counter cut, I need to know that that blade can deliver that cut. Or if he's cutting at me and I need to suddenly engage and close and interrupt his cut by clashing with it, you know, ricasso to ricasso, I need to know that blade can take it. There is a certain manufacturer whose blades cut phenomenally. I mean, just phenomenally. They were like razors, but I refer to his swords as glass swords because they always break when they hit anything resistant. And he refuses to make these blades blunt so that we can, you know, spar with them. He only makes them razor sharp, and he only tests cuts on soft materials. You know, that impresses people, but doesn't impress me. And I've broken like at least three of his swords.
When you test a blade and you're going to test it to see what it can really take, they're probably going to bend, they're probably going to break. At least you know the bounds. And I think if you're trying to sell it, sometimes you'll put out a blade to be tested to look for the good review, which makes sense when you're into it because you have to make money.
Right.
Nobody wants a bad review. And sometimes people testing blades might look at it and go, ooh, that bent, or this didn't, well, I mean, that's why it's called a test. It doesn't mean, you know, somebody says, okay, great, we'll bring it back.
Yeah, and we're not...
we'll do it again. I think that should be applauded.
Right, and we're not...
But I think people are scared to do it sometimes because they're so afraid of getting that one bad review. Yeah. I'd rather be seeing the guy that broke three, and then the rest of them never broke again because I learned a lot from it.
Exactly, and we're not trying to make a sword, or not trying to get any manufacturer to make an indestructible sword. Because recently I tested some Albions and I put online the results of the tests and I was praising the sword all over the place, even though I said at the end it eventually warped. And so it was not...
That's not a bad thing because the originals would have done that too.
It wasn't a test to destruction. It was a test up to the pushing the envelope of this weapon.
Right.
And the manufacturer understood this and appreciated it. And they still said to me, we're still going to try and make it better because we did have a few doubts about it.
That's a good way to look at it. But in my point of view, it's like, okay, we'll try them a little maybe make it bend less quickly, you know, depending upon how you were testing it. Hold up a little bit longer, but in the end, I'd rather have one bend than break. Because you can always straighten them. I don't think people understand that you straighten these things.
Yeah, although I did put an S-bend in this one.
Yeah, it's tougher. But now that also brings up, who can test? To me, a test cutter that's going to test one of my blades has to be very consistent in power, and there's a testing regime. Isn't just making it up on the spot. There should be something that can be written down and followed through.
Right.
I got this from the whole Japanese end, but actually more the Obata end, because he was very meticulous. But it also meant every time I sent a blade out there, if I didn't go out there with it myself, I knew what it was going to go through. I could compare all the way down through the lighter stuff, the heavier stuff, the heavier stuff, the heavier stuff, and knew where something changed or where it failed or where it didn't cut as well as the other one. And it, again, just like that fighter pilot engineering analogy, mm-hmm. you got to go up there and do loops and zip around and go, hey, it felt good. No, it's very precise, and the person cutting has to be able to do 100 cuts exactly the same angle with the same force.
Yeah.
And which is very difficult.
It takes practice.
A lot of other things to do, too.
That's what test cutting
should be.
Yeah. I know that when I don't cut things for several months and I go to cut, I know I always forget the little subtle lessons and screw up for the first, you know, dozen cuts. And then I go, okay, I got it now. And then I can cut things repeatedly. And we did some test cutting here recently, and we had about 9 of us, and I think about 5 of us cut. And I was cutting through things with swords that the younger, more novice students, rather, were unable to cut through using the same weapon on the same target. And I said, well, you know, that's because it takes practice, and, you know, cutting is a skill. And most of it is actually mental, because I'm just going up and striking, and I'm striking the same way whether I'm striking with a waster, a blunt, or empty air. And they're striking as if, okay, I'm using a sharp sword, I'm trying to cut, and I, you know.
Yes, so we just start getting lost in the thousand details versus just focusing on the cut, which is the experience part of it all.
But my criticism, of course, is of a lot of the Japanese test cutting you see is how they ritualize it to the point of absurdity.
Well, there's a balance between everything, and different schools do it different ways, too. So it's, I didn't run into that a lot during my testing and analysis. It was less rigid, more battlefield precise, but controlled.
Yeah.
Very controlled, very safe, but less of the ritual, because, you know, it was like we were out there in a testing field behind a smithy or somewhere, and we were just doing a written down, you know, pretty much in his head at that point, a series of tests that progressed and tested the blade till its utmost, which was nice, because I tested everything from, you know, these are, I'm going to throw out steel numbers again, 1050, W1, 1095, 1075, my own stuff, folded, not folded.
Right.
And going to the exact same test, you see, it's like, you know what, you can use the materials can vary quite a bit, but all these made it through to this point, and then these 5 made it through all the way to the end of this point.
Well, I've been testing on 2x4s after you showed me a sample of one that had been cut by Obata using a katana you made, and... So I've been testing different blades to see if I could get to a comparable distance, and I'm satisfied with what we've been doing. I like the 2x4, because you hit on a 2x4, nobody can say, oh, well, I don't know what kind of bamboo you hit, or I don't know what kind of cardboard tube you struck, or I don't know what kind of, you know, straw mat you struck. But if you say 2x4, there's no question what you're hitting, and anybody can go and get one and try it.
So, yeah.
The question is...
I mean, it can vary from... coast to coast too, but
well, if it's all pine 2x4,
yeah, if you're close to the same type of, that's hard cutting. So when a guy buys a sword, should that be done? I mean, would I recommend somebody go, you know, buys a, say, an Albion blade, and for test cutting you go out there and bang in a 2x4s? No, the company should be doing that, the test cutter should be doing that, and then everybody else can do.
Yeah.
What really, really tests the cutter, in my opinion, is the softer cutting. The edge angles through the thicker, you know, softer material.
Yeah, but that's a bit more challenging to get consistent soft material.
Yes, it is. Yeah,
yeah.
But one of those things is how much you're willing to dedicate to your art, and I really, really like the roll mat. I don't care what society they came from, I've used them in all different.
What's your opinion on taking a bunch of foam pool noodles and cutting on those?
I mean, call me semi-traditional, but it seems to be an established material, the mat, and you get a lot of cuts out of them. So still trying to convince some other people of the same thing in another culture. And I think you're seeing that, okay, we're really gauging how you want to cut and following your angle all the way through, which is why you're looking for that.
But then bamboo is
the material that you can analyze.
Cutting bamboo is traditional in Japanese test cutting.
Yep.
And
you can get the mats mailed to you anyway.
Yeah, I'm not impressed with bamboo.
And the bamboo is tougher.
I think bamboo is easy to cut.
Yeah, it is pretty much.
And so I don't think it's, and I see these Kenjutsu guys cutting on 2-inch diameter stalks of bamboo, and I'm like, yawn, because I can do that with a piece of completely blunt steel, and I can do it on a 3- and 4-inch piece of bamboo. So, I'm not as impressed by that as they're trying to make it out to be.
No, it doesn't shock the blade anywhere near as much, but it leaves a nice record. Through the material, you can see what your edge angle was.
But then they start talking about the aesthetics of the cut, and I've hit bamboo, thick bamboo, and I'll get on video where we cut through 3/4 of the piece of bamboo, and then it shatters the rest of the bamboo.
Yeah.
And it shatters it because we're using a narrower, double-edged blade.
Why would that shatter it versus a single-edged?
I think because of the thicker riser and the shorter bevel. And
it helps pop it apart.
The more tapered blade, it twists easier. But I always point out, well, if that was your shin bone and it had shattered like that, you wouldn't be standing and fighting. And sure enough, when you look at the skeletal remains from the Battle of Visby in 1361 off the coast of Sweden, they found many of the shin bones had been cut halfway through and then the shin bones splintered.
That's a great book, by the way. Anybody that can get that, that's interested in this stuff, should really get a copy or at least look at a copy. But which makes sense too, if you've got weight on that shin bone, if it wasn't mounted, at the time, you put that damage into that shin, and the weight, it's going to snap over, like felling a tree. Again, you may not. We were talking about armor before. You're not going to maybe cut cleanly through somebody all the way through, even if they got. Like woolen long coat on or something. But you're going to do some damage to the structure underneath, which is what you're looking for.
Right. Well, I have Dr. Sidney Anglo provided me with an account from, I believe it was 1886, which is just absolutely fascinating. And it's this major, British Army major from India, who's complaining about the British Army's adopting a new method of military swordplay that's based upon Italian civilian saber. And he says it's useless for combat. And he says and he gives a whole bunch of criticism of it. But his last criticism is the worst part is with this new method, you cannot hurt a man. that's a pretty significant method. I would have started with that one myself.
Yeah, that's pretty important.
And he says that you cannot kill someone using this new method because they're cutting from the wrist and the elbow and they're using these more slender, lighter sabers. So he concocts a test and he has the British Army take this gymnast coach who's really buff. And they train him for 3 months in just the new method using the new swords. And then Major H comes out and he says, I'll represent the old method using these older swords, which are an older, wider, heavier saber. And the older method uses large cuts from the shoulder and different footwork and different, more battlefield effective. And this guy, Major H, has killed guys all over India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, right? And so they hang a sheep's carcass up and they test all 6 cuts. They don't do 8 cuts. They just do 6. Diagonal and horizontal and vertical. And so they record the results of each of these cuts using each man doing one cut, and they record the difference. And the gymnast, they for each one of his cuts, they write no effect, no effect, no effect, broke the skin of the sheep. Cut into the muscle tissue to a superficial degree, cut into the muscle tissue and touched the bone, no effect, no effect, things like that, right? Then when it comes to Major H, for each one of his cuts, the results are sheep carcass cleaved completely through. Ditto, 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 ditto.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, so it goes from the other guy has no effect, or he just breaks the skin, or he just cuts into the muscle a little bit, to this guy shearing completely through the target. And so because of this, the British Army said, okay, well, maybe we better reconsider this, except that there was a bunch of officers who were pushing their own books on fencing, and their fencing books were for a method that was suitable for the salon, the soleil, you know, for sport fencing in the studio, and then for the parade ground. And then they assumed it would also work in combat because, after all, they're being taught by Italians. Italians who were not engaging in real combat. And the major even says, why are we adopting a method by Italians who are notorious for not fighting lethal duels or fighting duels in which either man has any real chance of being hurt? And we all know this.
Yeah.
And he's writing this in 1886.
And I'm sure that's not the first time through history nor the last it's going to happen with a weapon system.
Right. But within 10 years, they're all shooting machine guns, so...
So they were okay.
Yeah, they kind of dropped
it. That's an excellent story. And it just shows that, I mean, the testing... I bet you can go back and somebody else saying, look how good my sword is. And we test on the same thing, a sheep carcass. Oh,
right.
Wow, this guy makes good stuff.
Or, yeah, I have the battlefield
tested. And if something's not working or they're breaking or they're bending, they're going to... It's that almost natural selection from the battlefield that a certain type of manufacturer, or a sword, or a school of manufacturer, or just a smithing family themselves would carry on because they were effective.
Exactly.
You know, war's a pretty serious thing, and when you find out things don't work, they usually don't survive.
Well, I have all the details on it. I'm going to put it in my next book, so it'll be very useful.
That is good.
I think something that bothers me is I had someone contact me once and say, I'm going over to visit Deltin, Fulvio Deltin in Italy, and I'm going to interview him. And I said, well, that's nice. I'm not interested. And they go, why not? And I said, well, because he doesn't really make anything anymore that is of any use for us. And they're going, you're kidding. And I said, well, no, he doesn't. And then I started saying, well, look, and I said to this person, you like guns, right? And they said, yeah, because I knew they were into guns. I said, well, let's imagine for a moment that nobody makes any guns anymore. And you have interest in historical firearms of the 20th century. And a company is making them. And they're saying, here's our battle-ready, historically accurate pistols. And you buy one and you go to the range with it. And after a couple months of using it, you notice that it's not very accurate. It doesn't always hit the target. It fires off to the left or something. And you also notice that it has a tendency to jam. And it actually has a tendency to blow up in your hand sometimes. And you go and you tell this to the manufacturer, and they go, well, yeah, well, that's how guns work. And you go, oh, it is? Yeah, trust us. That's how a revolver is supposed to work. That's how a 45 is supposed to work. So you go, okay, I guess you know better. But you're still puzzled by that. And then after a couple of years of playing with real antique guns and talking to other people, you begin to doubt that this manufacturer was telling you the truth, or you doubt that they know what they're talking about, such that you go to them and you say, hey, I have some other guns, or I fired real guns now, and they were accurate, they did have good range, and they did penetrate, and they didn't jam, and they didn't blow up my hand. So why is it you're saying that your guns, which do, are accurate and battle ready? And they give you this look like, no, trust us. Yeah, these are accurate. And then you have to stop and conclude, okay, either you are lying to me and think I'm an idiot, or you don't know any better yourself and you don't know how to handle that you're wrong. So which is it? Either you don't know and can't make real guns, or you know you're not making real guns, but you're deceiving the customers anyway. And that's kind of where we are in the historical sword making, consuming, you know, community, because a lot of sword makers out there, we've concluded, either don't know or that they're not making good weapons, or they do know and can't admit it.
Yeah, and then there's the third thing too. Is like, well, for $300, I'm making them as well as we can make them.
That's true.
I can't even tell. I don't even want to tell you what some of my custom stuff goes for, but it's only about $300. So.
Yeah.
But and it's not because of anything else. Just add up the time and technique and all that fun stuff.
So you are making custom stuff.
Yeah.
But you're not soliciting for business.
Oh, I've never gone. I've gone to I think one show in my life, way long time ago, and I don't advertise. Even you know the whole History Channel you know, was on. I've never released my name or number off of that.
Right. And how many times a month, on average, do I forward you an email from someone requesting to
thank you
be your apprentice or to purchase something from you?
I'm very good about that. But it's,
I know, but how many of those do you actually accept? No apprentices, I know.
Yeah, but really, I mean, I've only gotten back to maybe a couple people on something like that because I'm just full from what I want to do for myself and for some close customers and friends. And
so do I get a finder's fee for ARMA for that?
No.
Oh, damn. I'll take a sword instead. Yes, you can pay me in swords.
Yeah,
we'll,
write that down.
We'll fence for food.
But really, I haven't, I just really don't work that way. I've got enough of a network now that the people I do know, if I want to make something, I can sell it. And I can also just do research for a year and make my own stuff. I mean, I really don't own my own pieces.
Well, yeah, that's what I like about you and Dan Maragni as well, is that anything that you guys produce, you're willing to say, hey, will you test this? You know, and give us feedback on it, because, you know, that adds to our knowledge when we're testing pieces. You know, for example, Dan has these really nice Norman short swords that a number of us have played with. And I was like, hey, aren't these things a bit too heavy? You know, they feel a little sluggish. And aren't they too sharp for the type of sword that they are? And then Dan's telling me that how accurate they are and what his sources are. And I'm like, really? And then when I see the things perform, I was astonished that these things were like freaking lightsabers.
Yeah, I mean, I've held the original to that one too, and it's, they're very, very good reproduction.
And it gets back to what you said earlier, which was, what is a lot of people's idea of what a sword should be? Where does that come from? The conception of what a sword is, where does that come from for most people? It comes from movies and television and games.
Right, or what their and what their physical capabilities are right now.
Right.
So what
yes.
I mean is somebody hasn't worked out with a sword for years, didn't grow up with it like that, didn't have it in their hand, you know, when they turn into a man at 15, like in some cultures, they just pick one up now because it finally got some money, they got a job, 18 or whatever.
Yeah.
And they pick it up and it's like, ooh, this is heavy. Yeah, this isn't any good. So they pick the one up that feels comfortable. I'm not saying swords are heavy and unwieldy by any means, but what may feel comfortable for you is not what a real sword was.
Right.
And there's one line, I forget what the movie is, it's 13th Warrior.
Right.
And one of the characters just grabs a sword and boom, it goes to the ground. You know, kind of silly, but it's like I can't lift this sword. And the little Viking guy hops up the boat and goes, grow stronger. You know, and I just like that because there's a lot there for wrist and forearm strength and shoulder and back that you're just not gonna have if you're just typing at a keyboard all day.
Well, you're preaching to the choir. Actually, you're preaching to the Pope now.
Well, you know exactly what I mean.
Yeah,
so,
because
what sword you choose to get into, like that Norman blade. That's a big long blade, but you probably would have on a horse at the same time you're using it.
Yes.
When somebody picks up a blade,
and not only that, you'd have like how many pounds of mail on your arm and shoulder?
Yeah.
When you're swinging it around.
And that guy was the M1 of the day, just coming through and just crashing through,
you know,
whatever.
A nice experiment I like doing, I'll show people a particular Del Tin piece. I think they call it the Venetian infantry sword. It's similar to the Norman sword blade, but it has a knuckle bar on it and some side rings. And it's a real arm breaker. It's very sluggish. And I let people play with it for a few seconds or handle it for a minute. And then I say, now. And I take it from them, and I put a gauntlet on their hand. I say, try it now. And they go, oh, man, God, whoa. Because wearing the steel gauntlet, and I'm talking about a contemporary early 16th century gauntlet, which is perfect for the sword, even though the sword has a knuckle bar on it, this fingered gauntlet I have, when you use the sword with this fingered gauntlet, the sword feels completely different. And you can swing it around with your full arm, and you can maneuver the tip, and you can do all these slicing and all these moves that you can't do without the gauntlet. And it's like, why? It's because that extra bit of weight balances that weapon for the arm. And it makes me say, I wonder how many swords out there were devised with the consideration that you should be wearing armor.
Yeah, it's a weapon system, right? It's not just the sword, it's the balance. Well, here's the balance point of my sword. You know, I'm technical about it. It's like, well,
right.
The guy using it's going to have the gall at the end of his wrist.
Yeah, I played with one of Peter Johnson's swords that I thought was too light, and it was a tapered early 15th century sword, and I just found it too light. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't really feel like I could really devastate a man with this blade. And then I'm looking at one of the historical images of a man in full plate armor using the exact same weapon, and I'm going, you know, I bet you if I had all that armor on, I wouldn't want something that required me to put a lot of inertia behind it. I would want something that I can just twirl around and just use like a giant ice pick, and that I'm, you know, that's not going to add to the weight I'm already carrying.
Mm-hmm.
So
limited visibility, getting in close. I mean, well, yeah, that's why you have to study the original piece.
Right, because Peter's telling me that this is an absolutely 99% accurate weapon, and I had to conclude, well, then it's just not a style I like, because you know, people have different preferences. That's why there were so many different kinds of blades.
Yeah, and it wasn't like they're all made in one factory. So
exactly,
you know, 99% is for that blade that either I would measure or he would measure or somebody would measure. Like, okay, I reproduced this blade.
Yeah.
And was that blade sharpened a lot, or was it originally like that, or was it pristine, that's perfect? There's such a big range
right
out there too, even within the styles. I think these days people get so used to seeing a typology. I think I was just talking about this with Dan Maragni. And a typology is not a Bible.
Right.
Typology made just so you can organize things in your head.
Yes.
And organize things by time. But because something looks a little bit different, well, like, Jesus, is that an 18? I don't know. It's kind of got this. Like, well, you know, if you look at how many swords are in existence, that typology back when was actually derived from, we're not talking a million different blades of all different styles and you've got these things down there. I mean, sometimes a typology may be, you know, there's two blades that exist. And that's it. So, I mean, of one type. So they're guidelines.
Yeah.
And finding one type 15 that you like doesn't mean the next type 15 actually
right
like that.
Yeah, I have on video Oakshott when I was interviewing him in his home a few months before his death. And he said that his typology was never meant to be any type of hard classification system. It was just a way to arrange our understanding of the different forms. And that the people who had criticized it, because apparently a few curators and arms collectors had criticized it for being rigid, he said, it's just the opposite. You can say that there's a type A, you know, there's a type 15A, 15B, 15C, D, E, F, G, H, what have you. On and on. He said that he fully expected people to add to the typology, to say, here's a type 27, you know. And he said the reason that he did this is because he told me that in Europe, particularly in Spain, that there was all these old manor houses and estates and castles all over the place that had large collections of weapons that had never been cataloged before, never been classified, never been examined, and never been recorded, and that they were just inside of these cabinets and lockers and basements and attics and inside of these storerooms, and that he had seen some of these, and he saw types of swords which seemed to be one of a kind, or pieces which there was no other matching specimen he had ever come across before, but he was unable to draw it or photograph it or anything, and that he knew that the number of pieces in his typology represented only a fraction of what existed, and that there are pieces that are not reflected in historical artwork. And not in museums.
That's a hugely important bit of information.
Yes, and he was lamenting that these collections were going to be bought up by arms dealers and sold at auctions, secret auctions, so that they would be locked away in some, you know, wealthy guy's, you know, collection, and you will never see them, and they'll never get put into the public domain, and they'll never get studied. And he says the arms dealers will get hold of a piece and go, oh, well, this piece doesn't fit any of the typology, therefore it's not going to sell, so let me strip the hilt off, put another hilt on it, and sell it as a type 21, you know. And it really, really angered him that this was, he said, what these really totally unscrupulous arms dealers do.
That's, I can't agree enough. I didn't know he actually said that. But
yeah.
Looking at it and just reading and knowing how many pieces of, or seeing some originals, like, really, there's only about 12 of these things around, and it's its own type, and everybody's just locking it in. But it's good as a guide, but people really shouldn't say, well, that doesn't look like this company's, you know, type 10.
Right.
Therefore, it can't be. Like, but it also doesn't give you the license just to go crazy and say, hey, I'm making my own style.
Well, it does give people a way of having a common language. If you say type 15, people go, oh, okay. You know,
The ballpark you're in, what the weapon was probably for.
Right.
You can get a rough silhouette in your head, and then it's like, oh, wow, this Type 15 has a reinforced point. Oh, I haven't seen that before.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Neat. The real beauty of his system is that he was basing it upon blades, which nobody had done prior. Everybody was classifying the weapons on their length and size and then on their hilt. And he said that's irrelevant. Because, you know, the size, length, hilt is irrelevant. All that matters is the blade shape, the blade geometry. And of course, now we know that there's more aspects to the geometry than just their width and thickness and cross-section.
Right.
Like the pieces in the Walls collection that seem to be Type 12s, but they're actually single-edged.
Like you said, it's a good way for people to use as a guide, to at least be talking about the same style or class, get you in the ballpark without having this ambiguous sword, and you got to give all the dimensions.
Yeah.
Type 15, here we go. Oh, yeah, okay, I know what you mean. And then look at the difference off of some, standard, but some common picture of a Type 15. Then you can go off of that. Yeah, but the handle's longer than that. Oh, okay.
Right.
And that's so important, because otherwise you'd spend all your time just trying to describe what you were talking about to somebody in these just atrociously boring just dimensions, figures, or you have to show a specific picture to everybody every time you talk about it. But hopefully the market will kind of not get locked in and just think of them as one type, as it's drawn. And really... Mm-hmm. That way, people are making a reproduction of something, and somebody looks at it and goes, oh, that doesn't look familiar. We'll give the guy a shot.
Yeah.
Like, if he can back up where he got it from, it's historical.
Well, another thing is, there's a lot of swords in the historical literature, images of swords, which do not survive. No known specimen survives, but here we have an image of the sword in the literature. And I would like to see some weapons made that reflect those unique pieces.
And even then, taking a lot of knowledge from a lot of different blades,
right,
of how they taper. It's not just, you know, straight distal taper. There's so many different sections, so to speak, starting off thick, a little straight here, over the butt taper a little further down, carries that length on for a while, then tapers more consistently for the last 6 inches. There's a lot of complex tapering going on to get the balances right, and how the weapon feels under shock. That, you know, to look at a picture of one, you'd have to kind of find something similar that was used against a similar armored or unarmored opponent, then try to apply those tapers to it. Would you get it exactly right? Hey, you don't know.
Right.
But as close as we can ever get without actually finding an original.
Now, you mentioned something about a reinforced point. You want to clarify what you meant by that?
Oh, maybe where the point swells out a little bit thicker for the last 3 inches than actually the rest of the blade.
Yeah, on a short tapering sword?
Oh, no, yeah, I've seen it on like a Type 15 style before. You see them in some other cultures. Indian and stuff is pretty common. But,
And then
the thrusting blade, with the last couple inches of the blade is actually, you know, a diamond cross section, but it's thicker at that midrib than it is 6 inches down the blade.
Right.
It flares back out. And I've seen that done, there's a big two-hander I've seen too, where, you know, it's actually 8 inches from the hand, from the cross, the guard, it actually gets a little bit thicker. And then it starts to taper down again. Like, huh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I saw recently a rapier that had flanges just above the cross, and that freaked me out.
Hmm.
A rapier with flanges. And I said, well, that's a first. And then I also saw a piece that was a wave blade, a flame blade, flamard, flambard, flamberger, different names for it. And it was clearly a single-handed cut and thrust or side sword, and yet it was a wave blade. And I said, well, I'll be darned. Now, I had no idea. I mean, I knew there were two-handed wave blades. I knew there were even rapier wave blades. But I did not know that they had ever made short swords or side swords that were that way. And it seemed so obvious. After I saw it, I said, well, of course. You know, if you can do it on a two-handed and you can do it on a rapier, you can do it in everything in between.
Yeah, you just don't think about it. And then somebody who had that made for them or whatever is like, you know, I like this. Let's make it that way.
You know, I tell you.
You know, some things can be influenced by the customer.
I've been collecting images of curved blades from European curved blades from the Dark Ages all the way up to the 17th century to try and distinguish between falchions, messers, batelaires, bracumars, and scimitars, and sabers, to try and determine whether they actually fit in the different families or not, and try and determine which blades actually show a Turco-Arabic influence and which ones don't. And it's been...
It's so simple when it was just Europe was straight, double-edged, you know, everybody else was curved.
It's been very difficult.
It's so much nicer now, so much richer, especially when you see, like you talk about the influence, which is a whole other hour-long conversation on that.
Yes.
Where influence came from and why. That's incredibly important. Even in the armor, you start seeing, you know, Eastern influence, things going back and forth. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think what I'll probably end up doing is making this a two-parter interview, and that will give our members more to listen to and more to question about. And hopefully we haven't talked too much around them or over their heads, because I know you and I have talked so much that sometimes we skip things that... other people might be saying, hey, wait a minute, what are you talking about?
Yeah, how'd you get from point A to point C?
Right.
Like, oh yeah, there was B in there. We did that a couple months ago.
Well, let me just remind our listeners that if you go and reread the piece, How Swords Are Really Made, so much of what we talked about is in there. So much of what we've talked about over the years has eventually made its way into that. So that's a really good primer on all this.
Yeah, like I said, any questions of anything that I said or somebody took it the wrong way. Actually, those are, you know, whatever. Somebody could get upset whatever I said.
Not our members, no.
If somebody has a real question on, well, what do you mean by this? Because that doesn't sound like what this guy said or something. Just write them down and give me a call.
Yeah.
I'll try to explain what I mean and more clearly.
When are you going to be able to reproduce magic swords?
I've been working on that for a while. I'm only halfway there, which is the design phase. Actually making it work, not quite.
So you get the design phase down, then the magic comes later.
Yeah, I know that it's a sword, and I'm pretty much going to put magic in it. But I haven't really gone to the shop on that one yet. But we're working on it.
Okay, well, that's great. All right, well, thanks a lot, Paul.
All right, you have a great one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.